I'm Alan McClellan from WCRB. I had the opportunity to sit down with cantata singers music director David Hoos the other day to chat about Brahms's German Requiem. It's a piece that's often done with an enormous chorus. Cantata singers is a fairly small group. I asked David about the challenges this presents.
A lot of people were very surprised that cantata singers, a chorus of mid-40 in number, would take on this piece that is really associated with choruses of 150, 200. And it does certainly have a grandeur with that many people. But I was hoping that something else would be revealed in a sense of clarity, in a sense of articulation, a sense of phrasing, and a sense of intimacy, a kind of ability for the performers and mostly for the listener to hear into the piece. I think Brahms is often misperceived as a composer who is heavy, but that doesn't seem to me to be really the point. That sound of any sort, thick, thin, light, dark, is not an end in itself, but a consequence of many other factors, mostly having to do with phrasing and having to do with a rhythmic sense and a sense of flexibility. And out of that comes a sense of what the weight in the color is. So we set out to perform the Brahms. Admittedly, we did not do it with 44 singers. We raised the number to 55, but still that number is relatively small. And in fact, there were, as I recall, and there always have been, almost exactly the same number of orchestral musicians on stage as there have been singers. And unsurprisingly to me, from having looked at the piece, it was all very clear. The piece's balances worked quite beautifully. Brahms was so savvy as an orchestrator, and by that I mean also the way he treated the chorus. When he needs the chorus to be heard, with the exception of one place in the piece, he puts the chorus in a most advantageous place. He doesn't imagine that one singer, you know, equals one horn player. It's not that way. And so he finds ways to give the chorus inherent strength that, and as a consequence, you don't need an enormous chorus to sing the piece. And I think with mature singers, as cantata singers is blessed to have, and really fine musicians, when the performance is very focused and the singing is at a high level, I think you can come away with a performance that maybe reveals new things, but mostly allows the performers to find new things in it that might or might not be present or might be harder to find in a different kind of performance.
And it has been there for the history of the cantata singers. How many times?
I think this was our third, perhaps our fourth set of performances. Another thing that I think has informed our performances has been that we've never done the Brahms Requiem as the only piece on the program. Often it is, and that's fine. It's a 70-minute piece. It doesn't need anything else. But we've always paired it with other works that I hoped in some way would shed some light on the piece, or maybe the Brahms would shed some light back onto whatever works there were in the first half. One time we did the Brahms with the Schoenberg First Chamber Symphony, Opus 9. Relatively early Schoenberg work, very condensed, kind of virtuosic piece for 13 instruments. One time we did it with a Busoni piece and the Kurt Weill Violin Concerto. In this performance, we paired it with a Bach cantata 60, called subtitled Dialogue Between Hope and Fear, and one Webern work, the five movements for string orchestra and Webern's orchestration of Bach's Ricercari. I thought that first the cantata could shed a lot of light on this very personal work of Brahms, because the Bach not only is a very personal piece for us and for the composer, but it also happens to end with the very famous chorale, Es ist genug, which becomes the foundation for the Alban Berg Violin Concerto. So with the Webern works, the very short Webern works, and the Webern-Bach kind of amalgamation, and then this Bach cantata, I thought that those three works together prepared the way in so many different, from different avenues, the way for the Brahms. And it also helps humanize the Brahms. Brahms called it a human requiem, and of course all requia are, but I understand what he means, but sometimes we hear the piece and it's official sounding. It's a little bit distant sounding, I think, and it lacks a certain immediacy. It's very beautiful music. There's no disputing. But I do think that Brahms, almost through his compositional career, did a lot to hide himself emotionally. The music is, by and large, so beautifully crafted and exquisitely orchestrated. And the thought behind the music is kind of perfect. But there is an emotional holding back in, I think, a lot of the music. I think it's true in the symphonies. I think it's certainly true in the Requiem, even in the chamber music.
Even when he's doing these beautiful melodies.
Oh, absolutely.
You would think they're hard-on-the-sleeve melodies, but they're not really. They're kind of reserved.
There is a reserve to them. And the interesting thing is that a lot of people that I've mentioned that idea to argue with me passionately as if I've somehow really missed the point of Brahms, because they find the music so passionate and they connect to the music so passionately. The emotions that Brahms is revealing and inviting us into are universal ones. He's tapped into the kinds of reactions that you and I and hundreds and hundreds, thousands of people have as just as human beings. But he's not saying, I, Johannes, want to show you me. That's something that Robert Schumann does. And it's so personal, that music is so personal that some people are shut out from it, because it's too personal.
They're almost embarrassed.
And there is something, yes, they can be embarrassed by it because it is so heart on sleeve and a little bit crazy at times. Brahms is seldom crazy. It's really in the later works, the clarinet quintet, where Brahms, I don't even think intentionally lets himself out, but it, and some of the late piano works show him to be a very depressed person. And you can't help but hear it. But in this very young man's Requiem, that doesn't show. Instead, it has a universality that invites all of us in, embraces us all, gives us a great sense of musical and emotional community. And there is hardly a piece that touches more people and connects with more people than I think does this German Requiem.
You've touched on the question that was in my mind, which is, and it's a maybe impossible to answer question, but the why question. Why did Brahms write this, do you think?
You know, the movement with soprano that comes late in the piece, soprano and chorus, was not actually part of the piece originally. It might have been in his mind. But when the first performance happened, that movement wasn't in it. And he later put the movement in, and it's seen as a memorial to his mother, who had died and to whom he was very close. And some people see the whole Requiem as really relating to his mother. But he generalizes on it. even if the Brahms Requiem is, in some sense, a memorial to his mother, it still has broad reach, wide arms that really let almost all of us in.
He emphasizes some things, maybe not wanting to include other things. In other words, he emphasizes the comfort aspect.
Yes, and there's very little specific theology in the piece. That is, while the verses are from the Bible, there's not mention of Jesus or Christ, and it's a humanist requiem based on biblical texts. So the biblical verses that Brahms turns to are ones that, in a way, invoke no specific religion or creed, but they are words that really almost anyone, regardless of theological bearing, can relate to.
And I think that disturbed some people in Brahms's time, didn't they? There's something I read about someone who inserted, "I know that my Redeemer liveth," from Messiah.
Oh, just so. Well, that's true. I read that. But you know, they did that all the time. I mean, the people didn't have the kind of reverence for large works that we might have today, and did not necessarily see their compositional entirety as something that really shouldn't be broken. So yeah, they would put arias into the middle of, by other composers, into the middle of Handel oratorios, and it was a little bit hard to imagine what it would have been like, but it was a different mindset.
But he, at the same time, was, I guess his message was not light or frivolous or insignificant as a result of wanting to avoid traditional dogma.
Not at all. I think by avoiding traditional Christian theology, he really enables the piece to, as I say, reach a broad spectrum of people. But the piece is plumbing the depths of despair and optimism and looking beyond. It certainly does not result in anything lighthearted. In fact, very little of Brahms' music is really lighthearted. Even, you know, the scherzos in the symphonies, they're lively, and they might be heartfelt in some way, but there's not a lot of fun in Brahms. But that's not to say it's not deeply moving and touching and transformative in some really marvelous, kind of inexplicable way.
Joyous that is a word.
Well,
that
there
comes
is
to my mind.
Certainly a lot of joy in the German Requiem, enormous amounts. And you can forget, while you're in the midst of it, that this is a requiem. You think of the Mozart Requiem, and some of it is solemn, and some of it is personal and touching, but a lot of it is angry. And there's not even a lot of anger in the Brahms Requiem. There's a resolute sense, a sense of acceptance, a sense of looking to the larger universe, and certainly in the last movement, looking beyond this earth.
He's facing death full in the face, you know, it seems to me anyway. It's not an avoidance of the reality of death at all.
No, the second movement in particular, and other, some of the internal movements certainly have a kind of grimness, that, not anger, just grimness, that, and fury sometimes. But in the last movement, there are ways in which the music visits areas, emotional areas, and a musician would say, you know, tonal areas or harmonic areas that are really unseen anywhere else in the entire Requiem. And there are ways in which ideas are become transformed in many of the movements, especially toward the end of the piece, when you have a sense that even though there are thoughts that reach way back to the beginning of the Requiem, that there are thoughts that are now seen in a completely new light and with a kind of luminosity, that the darker colors of the opening movement, a movement that has no oboes in it, has no violins in it, you know, just the low strings and the lower woodwinds and the horns and the trombones, things like that, but not a lot of weight in the first movement, but in the last movement, there's a luminosity that, and a transparency, a kind of transparency that the other movements don't have, as if you're looking through to the world beyond.
Yeah, the biblical see through a glass darkly kind of thing, yeah, comes through. Yeah. When you prepare to perform the Brahms Requiem, as you have done it in various times and combined it with other different pieces, I wonder whether, you know, this time when you did it, you somehow thought perhaps Bach could speak to it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But I do believe that for the listener, the Bach and Webern works on the first half of this program did speak to how they heard the Brahms. And they also obviously affected how we heard the Brahms. But I wouldn't say that anything consciously in the first half of the program made me think, oh, that's in Webern's music or Bach's music, and therefore I either see it or need to hunt for it in Brahms's music. I think it's important to respect as much as you can, as is humanly possible, the efficacy of each composer's works and let them play off of each other. I remember one time when we performed the Fauré Requiem, and the first half of the concert was a performance of a late Stravinsky piece, Thraini, tough nut to crack, and a fantastic piece. Never had been performed in Boston. Can you imagine a big Stravinsky piece, its first performance in this city? And I was much younger. I had the sense that when it was over with, that poor Fauré Requiem suffered, not in comparison, but the performance of the Fauré probably suffered because there's a coldness to Stravinsky's music that is so captivating and infectious that it probably just spilled over into this Fauré Requiem performance, which probably was hard as nails, which is not something that the Fauré Requiem should be. They are polar opposites in a certain way, and just feeling the friction between them would be very intriguing. But I don't think I don't think it makes sense to consciously try to let one composer affect the other. They do in our head.
Perhaps the reserve that Brahms felt that you were describing is somewhat affected by his understanding of Bach and what Bach did.
Well, certainly Brahms was a fine conductor himself, and he edited, you know, he was one of the editors of the first Bach Gesellschaft, and he knew those cantatas. There's no doubt in my mind that the lofty integrity and imagination that Bach's music offers us affected Brahms's own writing, as did other composers like Heinrich Schütz, whose music he programmed quite a lot himself. And in a certain way, Brahms' music, to my ear, is closer to Schütz's music than Bach's music. I mean, a composer 100 years older than Bach. And certainly, when people do pair works with the Brahms Requiem, I sometimes see big works of Schütz, like the Musikalische Exequien, as the first half, and that makes a good deal of sense to me.
Seems intense to me.
Well, it is very intense because the Schütz is very dense and compact, but the Brahms has a kind of spaciousness and calm, even in the most sort of hysterical places.
Right.
There has a grandeur. And maybe if you hear those two pieces back to back, the way you hear the two pieces they're informed. Your memory of the Schütz, if that were, say, on the first half, and the way you're taking in the Brahms at this time.
This is all fantastic, and I appreciate your time here to do this. It's a delight, and looking forward to the broadcast of Brahms.
Thank you very much.